You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of the complete edition, Collected Works, Volume 175, of Building Stones for an Understanding of the Mystery of Golgotha, Human Life in a Cosmic Context, translated by Simon Blaxland DeLange. This is Lecture 3, given in Berlin on the 20th of February, 1917. The fruits of spiritual science can, through their essentially practical orientation, in the highest sense of the word, enable us to feel that the ordinary outer aspect of man's being has within it an inner aspect, which to all intents and purposes is completely distinct from the former outward aspect. In this respect, we as human beings consist of two beings, one of which is composed of our physical and etheric bodies, and belongs more to the outer world, outer in the sense that this physical body, and to a certain degree also the etheric body, are forms and images, that is to say manifestations, of the divine spiritual beings by whom we are constantly surrounded. Our physical and etheric bodies in their true essence, as opposed to how we, as human beings, know them initially, are images, not of us, of our real being, but are images, shall we say, of the gods, who find fulfillment in giving rise to and developing our physical and etheric bodies, just as we, as human beings, bring about our own actions. The inner aspect of man's being is more closely related to the astral body and ego. In the context of the universe, the astral body and ego are younger than the physical and etheric bodies. We know this from the information that has been recorded in the book titled Occult Science, also known as Esoteric Science. Our ego and astral body, as it were, reside within the protective sheath that is prepared for us by the divine spiritual beings who pervade the outer universe and make it manifest. And through the experiences, trials, and fluctuations of destiny that they, readers aside, I believe that is the ego and astral body, end of readers aside, they undergo, as a result of their association with the physical and etheric bodies, they are intended gradually to ascend to the stages of development with which we have already become familiar. As I indicated to you in the previous lecture, we have a very intimate connection with the entire universe, with the whole cosmos. And this connection is such that, as we saw from a brief exploration of numerical relationships, it can even be calculated and expressed in numbers. Although there are many, many ways in which this becomes apparent, it is to our great astonishment expressed by the fact that the number of breaths that a person takes in a day equals the number of years that the vernal point of the sun needs to return to the point where it began. If we ponder these numerical discoveries with our feelings, they can fill us with awe, with a holy awe, of the way that we belong to the divine spiritual universe, as it is manifested in all outward phenomena. This fact of our being the microcosm, the little world fashioned and manifested out of the macrocosm, out of the big world, is shown at a far deeper level if we consider the realities that I want to put before you today, which I might refer to as the three encounters of the human soul with the essential nature of the universe. That is, therefore, what I should like to speak about now. We all know that, as earthly human beings, we bear within us the physical body, the ether body, the astral body, and the ego. Each of the two aspects of man's being to which I have referred has within it two subordinate elements. The more outward aspect has the physical and etheric bodies. The more inward aspect has the ego and astral body. We also know that man will develop further through a Jupiter, a Venus, and a Vulcan planetary evolution. During this time, man will rise from one stage to another. We know, additionally, that a higher being will manifest within him that will develop beyond his ego. This will be the spirit self, which will come to full manifestation during the Jupiter evolution, which will follow Earth evolution. The life spirit will fully manifest itself within man during the Venus state age, and the actual spirit man during the age of Vulcan. Thus, as we anticipate the great cosmic future of mankind, we see before us this threefold evolution of the spirit self, life spirit, and spirit man. But these three further stages, which in a certain sense await us in our future evolution, already have a relationship to us today, even if they are not the least bit developed. For they are encompassed within the bosom of the divine spiritual beings whom we have learned to know as the higher hierarchies. We will be endowed with them from out of these higher hierarchies. Today we already have a relationship to these higher hierarchies, who will, in the future, bestow upon us the spirit self, the life spirit, and the spirit man. Thus, instead of saying in a somewhat complicated way, quote, "We are related to the hierarchy of the angels," close quote, we can simply say, quote, "We are related to what is to come in the future, to our spirit self," close quote. And instead of saying, quote, "We are related to the archangels," close quote, we say, quote, "We are related to the life spirit, which will come in the future," close quote, and so on. Indeed, we human beings already have a predisposition, and in the spiritual world, predispositions have a far greater significance than in the physical world, to be more than merely a fourfold being with a physical body, ether body, astral body, and ego. We already bear the germinal essence of the spirit self within us, also that of the life spirit and spirit man. They will evolve from us in the future, but we already possess them in their rudimentary form. Moreover, the manner in which they are present within us has nothing abstract about it. And when I say that we bear them within us, I mean this in a very real way, for we have actual encounters with these higher beings of our, with these higher members of our being. These meetings take place in the following way. We would, as human beings, increasingly come to feel estranged from the spiritual world, something that people find difficult to endure in our present age, if we were not able to encounter our spirit self from time to time. Our ego must meet with that higher member of our spirit self, which we have yet to develop, and which in a certain sense is of a similar nature to beings from the hierarchy of the angels. So, as one says when speaking in a Christian context, we must from time to time meet a being from the hierarchy of the angels who is particularly close to us, because when this being meets us, it brings about a spiritual change in us, which enables us at some future time to receive a spirit self. Similarly, we also need to have an encounter with a being from the hierarchy of the archangels, because this being brings about something within us which leads to the development of the life spirit, and so on. Whether in a Christian sense we assign this being to the hierarchy of the angels, or whether we speak more as the ancients did when they spoke of the daimon, of a person's guiding genius, makes no difference. We know that we are living at a time when only a few people, though this will soon change, who are able to behold the spiritual world and perceive its beings and other phenomena. The time has now passed when people beheld the beings of the spiritual world, together with its various developmental processes, to a far more extensive degree. And at the time when people spoke of the genius of an individual person, they were also able to have a direct perception of this genius. It was not so very long ago that this clarity of perception was so strong that it was possible to describe it quite concretely and objectively, and in terms that people today would regard as poetic, although nothing fanciful was intended. Thus, Plutarch describes man's relationship to his genius in the following way, and I should like to quote the actual passage. Plutarch, the Greek writer, says that aside from the part of the soul that is immersed in the earthly body, another pure part of it remains hovering above a person's head, and is like a star in appearance. And this part is rightly called his daimon, his genius, who guides him, and whom the wise man willingly follows. Thus Plutarch describes in this distinct way what he so much wants to be taken not as a poetic fancy, but as a clearly perceptible outward reality that he states explicitly. Quote, "The rest of the spiritual part of man's being can in a certain sense be perceived simultaneously with the physical body, so that the spiritual part normally occupies the physical body in the same space. But as for the genius, man's guiding and ruling spirit, it can be beheld as something special outside the head of every human being." Close quote. And Paracelsus, one of the last who, without any special training or talents, had powerful insights into these things, said on his own account roughly the same about this phenomenon. Many others gave a similar picture. This genius is none other than the budding spirit self, though born by a being from the hierarchy of the angels. It is deeply meaningful to immerse oneself in these things, for the particular nature of this genius can be discerned when it becomes perceptible, as one will come to understand if, for example, for this subject could be considered from a completely different point of view, but we will adopt this particular viewpoint. We arrive at a conception of the mutual relations of human beings. This theme has something to teach us, something that is by no means without significance with respect to the spiritual members of man's being. When two people encounter one another, and one is able to observe this encounter with one's physical vision, one notices that they come together and perhaps greet one another and so forth. But if one has the ability to observe such an event spiritually, one finds that with every human encounter, a spiritual process is associated, which comes to expression in that, for as long as two people are standing next to one another, the part of the ether body, which forms the head, becomes an expression of the most refined sympathy and antipathy that these two people who have come together feel for one another. Let us suppose that two people meet who cannot bear one another. We are taking an extreme case, but this undoubtedly happens. Suppose two people meet who cannot stand one another, and that this feeling of extreme antipathy is mutual. What then happens is that the part of the ether body that forms the head projects beyond the head of both individuals, and the etheric sheaths of the heads incline toward each other. When two people meet who cannot endure one another's company, their antipathy is expressed etherically as a continual inclining of the head. Whereas, when two people come together who love one another, a similar process can be observed. However, the etheric head in this case withdraws. It inclines backward. And so what arises in both these cases, whether the ether body inclines forward as if in greeting where antipathy is felt, or whether it inclines backward where there is a bond of love, is that the physical head becomes freer than it would otherwise be as a result of the balancing gestures of the etheric head. These movements are always only relative. The ether body does not reach out completely, but it shifts to some extent and then returns, so that some continuity can be observed. But in this way, a more rarefied ether body now fills the head than if one were on one's own. The consequence of this is that by virtue of the fact that this ether body that fills the head has become more rarefied, the astral body, remaining within the head, becomes more clearly visible to clairvoyant perception. So not only is there this movement of the ether body, but a change takes place in the astral light of the head. Hence the reason why, in circles where such things are understood, people who are capable of selfless love are portrayed with an aura around their heads known as a halo. Read that again. Hence the reason why, in circles where such things are understood, people who are capable of selfless love are portrayed with an aura around their heads known as a halo, is not that artists are indulging in creative license, but that an actual truth is involved. When two people meet one another in the ordinary way, so that in their love there is always a strong element of egotism, this phenomenon is not so apparent. But when a person comes in contact with others at moments where he is not concerned with himself and his own personal relationship to another individual, but with humanity in general, with an all-pervading love for mankind, such phenomena do indeed become visible. At such times, the astral body, in the region of the head, becomes clearly discernible. If people are present who are capable of clairvoyantly perceiving selfless love in another person, they will see the halo and are obliged to paint the halo as a reality, or in whatever way may be appropriate. These things are associated with objective facts of the spiritual world. But the objective elements of this situation, insofar as they are part of the ongoing reality of human evolution, are connected with something else. A human individual must from time to time enter into an inner communion with his spirit self, with the spirit self which is brought into being in an undeveloped form, in the astral aura that becomes so visible in what I have indicated to you, raying down from out of the future. He must from time to time be brought in touch with his spirit self. When does this occur? We now come to the first meeting of which we have to speak. When does this happen? It takes place during normal sleep, roughly in the middle of the period between the time of going to sleep and waking up. With people who are close to nature, the simple country people who go to sleep when the sun sets and rise with the dawning light, this midpoint more or less coincides with the middle of the night. With someone who is more detached from natural rhythms, this is less the case. However, human freedom requires that this should be possible. In present-day culture, people can organize their lives how they want, even though it is bound to have a certain influence on their lives, that within certain limits they can do so. Nevertheless, they can, in the middle of a long sleep, experience this intimate communion with the spirit self, with the spiritual qualities from which the spirit self will be derived, a meeting with their genius. So this meeting with one's genius takes place more or less every night, every time one goes to sleep. It is important that this happens, for the sense of contentment that one feels regarding one's connection with the spiritual world is dependent on the after effect of this meeting with one's genius during sleep. The feeling that we are able to have in our waking state of our connection with the spiritual world is an after effect of this meeting with our genius. This is the first encounter with the higher world, and it takes place initially unconsciously for most people, although they become increasingly conscious of it the more they become aware of its influence through refining the waking consciousness in their feelings, by absorbing the ideas and concepts of spiritual science, to the point where their souls are sufficiently sensitive to be able to observe these after effects. This meeting with the genius comes frequently to consciousness in some form or other, but the present materialistic environment, which is full of concepts deriving from a materialistic view of the world, and quite particularly the life of today, pervaded as it is with a materialistic attitude, do not enable the soul to be attentive to what is brought about as a result of this meeting with the genius. As people fill their minds with concepts that are more spiritual than any that materialism can offer, the perception of these nightly meetings with the genius will become more and more self-evident to them. The second meeting, of which we must now speak, is of a higher nature. You will be aware, from what I have already said, that this first meeting with the genius is associated with the course of the day. If we were to adapt our outward lives completely as people who do not have the freedom that we possess in our modern culture, this meeting would coincide with midnight. At the hour of midnight, every person would have this encounter with the genius. But it is in the nature of freedom that this meeting with the ego, that this meeting when the ego encounters the genius is no longer fixed. The second meeting, however, is not so movable. For what is connected more with the astral body and ether body is less movable with respect to the macrocosmic order. What is connected with the ego and physical body has a strong degree of mobility for people today. Thus, the second meeting is connected more with the great macrocosmic order. Just as the first meeting is connected with the daily rhythm, this second meeting is associated with the course of the year. At this point, I need to draw your attention to various things that I have already indicated in this connection from different points of view. Man's life in its entirety does not run its course in a similar way throughout the year, and there are certain distinct changes. In the summer, when the sun is at its hottest, man is far more strongly engaged with his physical life, and hence also with the physical life of his surroundings, than during the winter, when he has to battle against the outer elements of nature and is thrown back on his own resources. The spiritual part of his nature is also freer, both in itself and from the earth, and he is connected strongly with the spiritual world, with his whole spiritual environment. Hence the particular feeling that we associate with the Christmas mystery and the Christmas festival is by no means arbitrary, but it forms part of the timing of the Christmas festival. During those winter days appointed for the festival, both man and the entire earth give themselves up to the spirit. Man is therefore inhabiting a realm where the spirit is very close to him. The consequence of this is that around Christmas time, thus until our modern New Year, man experiences a meeting of his astral body with the life spirit, just as the first meeting entails an encounter of his ego with the spirit self. The possibility for Christ Jesus to draw near depends on this meeting with the life spirit, for Christ Jesus reveals himself through the life spirit. He reveals himself through a being from the realm of the archangels. He is, of course, an infinitely higher being, but this is not what we are concerned with at present. What we have to consider is that he manifests himself through a being from the realm of the archangels. Thus, with respect to modern evolution, evolution since the mystery of Golgotha, we draw particularly close to Christ Jesus through this meeting, and we can, in a certain sense, also call the meeting with the life spirit the encounter with Christ Jesus, which takes place in the very depths of our soul. Now, when a person, whether by developing spiritual consciousness in the realm of religious study and practice, or as a supplement to the religious feelings nurtured in this way, by absorbing the concepts and ideas of spiritual science, has intensified and spiritualized his feelings in the manner described. He will, in the same way that in waking life he is able to experience the after effects of the meeting with his spirit self, experience the after effects of the meeting with the life spirit, that is, with the Christ. And it is indeed the case that in the time following the period of Christmas until Easter, the conditions are particularly favorable for bringing clearly to consciousness the encounter that a person has with Christ Jesus. The period of Christmas is connected with earthly processes at a profound level, and this should not become blurred today through a materialistic way of looking at things. For man accompanies the changes taking place in the earth at Christmas. The time of Easter is determined by processes in the heavens. Easter Sunday falls on the first Sunday, following the first full moon after the vernal equinox. So whereas Christmas is governed by earthly circumstances, Easter is determined from above. Just as we are, through all that has been described, connected with earthly circumstances, so are we connected, through what I shall now relate, with heavenly circumstances, with what is going on in the wider expanses of the spiritual cosmos. For Easter is that time in the yearly cycle when everything that has been brought about in us through the meeting with Christ at Christmas time is fully united with our physical earthly humanity. And the great mystery of Good Friday, which brings the mystery of Golgotha to a focus for us as human beings at Easter time, has, in addition to much else, the significance that Christ, who has, as it were, been walking beside us at the time that I have been describing, now approaches us most strongly in that, to put it in a vivid picture, he disappears into us during the ensuing period of summer. When in the ancient mysteries, human beings sought to unite themselves at St. John's Tide with the macrocosm in a way that was not possible after the mystery of Golgotha. From this you can see that we are a microcosm, and that we are incorporated in the macrocosm in a deeply meaningful way. And in the cycle of the year, there is a continual union with the macrocosm, which is brought about through man's inner relationship to the year's course. In this way, spiritual science seeks gradually to reveal the insights that can be acquired through spiritual scientific research regarding the pervading and permeating of our earthly lives by Christ since the mystery of Golgotha. At this point, I need to make an interpolation which is important and needs to be thoroughly understood by those sympathetic to spiritual science. It should not be thought that our spiritual scientific endeavors should be a substitute for religious life and practice. Spiritual science can, to the highest degree, and especially with respect to the Christ mystery, be a support for and a foundation of religious life and practice. But one should not turn spiritual science into a religion. And one needs to be quite clear in one's mind that religion in its living form, and when practiced in a living way, kindles a spiritual consciousness of the soul within the human community. If this spiritual consciousness is to become a vital presence within man, he cannot continue to have abstract conceptions of God or Christ, but he must be constantly renewed through involvement in religious practice and activity, which can take the most divergent forms for different people, in something that surrounds him as a religious environment and speaks to him out of this background. And if this religious milieu is of sufficient depth and has the means of stimulating the soul, such a soul will also come to feel a longing for those ideas that are developed in spiritual science. Moreover, if spiritual science is, as it surely is, in an objective sense a support for religious edification, the time has now come when, from a subjective point of view, a person with true religious feelings is driven by these very feelings also to seek knowledge. For spiritual consciousness is acquired through religious feeling and spiritual knowledge through spiritual science, just as knowledge of the natural world is acquired through natural science. And spiritual consciousness leads to the impulse to gain spiritual knowledge. From a subjective point of view, one can say that an inner religious life can spur a person on today to spiritual science. A third meeting is when a person approaches the spirit man, which will be fully developed only in the far future. This meeting is mediated by a being belonging to the hierarchy of the archai. We may say that people in ancient times, as people also do in our present time, although when they speak of these things, they no longer have an awareness of the deeper truths involved, experienced this meeting as an encounter with that which pervades the world, a presence which we are barely able to distinguish any longer in ourselves or in the world, but where our selfhood is absorbed in the world as in a unity. And just as in the case of the second meeting one can speak of an encounter with Christ Jesus, so with the third meeting one can speak of an encounter with the Father principle, with the, in quotes, Father, who represents the very ground of the world, with that being whom one experiences when one has a true feeling for what the various religions mean by the Father. This meeting is of such a nature that it reveals our intimate relationship to the macrocosm, to the divine spiritual universe. The daily course of universal processes, of world processes, includes our meeting with our genius. The yearly course includes our meeting with Christ Jesus. And the course of the whole of a human life, this human life of ours, which can generally be designated as the patriarchal life of 70 years, coincides with the meeting with the Father principle. For a certain period of our physical earthly life, by rights through education, although at present largely unconsciously, we are prepared for, and then experience, in the case of most people unconsciously between the ages of 28 and 42, though in a very real way in the intimate depths of the soul, this meeting with the Father principle. The after effects of this may extend into later life, if we develop a sufficient degree of sensitivity in our feelings, to be aware of what emerges from within ourselves as an influence in our lives deriving from this meeting with the Father principle. During the period of our lives when we are being prepared, our education should, and this can happen in a variety of ways, be making this meeting with the Father principle as profound an experience as possible. This can happen if during the period of his education a person is urged to develop strong feelings about the splendor and magnificence of the world and the sublime nature of its processes. We considerably deprive children and adolescents if we fail to draw their attention to the beauty and grandeur of the world for which we feel the greatest reverence and devotion, so that this passes them by. If we enable young people to feel a real connection in their hearts with beauty and with the greatness of the world, we are preparing them for a real meeting with the Father principle. For this meeting has a considerable significance for the life between death and a new birth. This meeting with the Father principle, which generally occurs in the years indicated above, signifies that a person has a considerable degree of strength and support when, after he has passed through the gate of death, he has, as we are aware, to retrace his life's path, his earthly journey, retrospectively as he passes through the soul world. This retrospective journey, which as we know lasts for one-third of the time spent between birth and death, can and should be a powerful experience if the person concerned is able to see. Here at this point I met with that being whose existence comes to expression in dimly intuitive, stammering words when people speak of the Father of the Cosmic Order. This is an important picture, which together with the picture of death itself, a person needs to have once he has passed through the portal of death. There is, of course, an important question that arises in connection with this. Some people die before they have reached the middle of their life, which is when the meeting with the Father Principle normally takes place. We need to consider the situation where someone dies because of some outward cause, through illness, which is indeed such an outward cause, or weakness of some kind. If because of this early death, the meeting with the Father Principle in the subconscious depths of the soul has not yet become possible, it happens in the hour of death. This meeting is experienced when death occurs. At this point, it is of relevance to speak in a somewhat different way of what I have already brought to expression in, for example, my book Theosophy, where there is a reference to the invariably tragic phenomenon of people bringing their lives to an end through their own will. No one would do this who was aware of the significance of such a deed. And once spiritual science has really fully entered into people's feelings, there would no longer be any suicide. For in order that a person may perceive the Father Principle directly after death occurs, in a case where death takes place before the middle of life, it is necessary that death approaches him from without, rather than through being self-inflicted. The difficulty that befalls the human soul, and which is described from another viewpoint in my Theosophy, might be described from the standpoint from which I am speaking today, if I were to say that through a death that is self-inflicted, the individual concerned deprives himself of the meeting with the Father Principle in this incarnation. Because they are so intimately involved with our lives, the truths that spiritual science is able to impart to us about human life have such infinitely serious implications in instances of particular importance. They bring us clarity about our lives in a serious way. And this serious illumination regarding their lives is needed by people at a time when they need to extricate themselves from materialism, which governs the present world order and the prevailing world conception, insofar as these depend on human beings. More powerful forces will be needed to overcome the strong connection with the purely material powers that have taken hold of people today, in order once more to give them the possibility of recognizing their connection with the spiritual world from their immediate experience of life. Whereas one speaks in a more abstract way of the beings of the higher hierarchies, one can speak in a more concrete way of how the human individual himself can ascend in three stages through experiences, which, while being initially unconscious, may be brought to consciousness during his life between birth and death. Through the meeting and the genius, through the meeting with Christ Jesus, and through the meeting with the Father. Of course, a great deal depends on our acquiring as many ideas as possible that call forth feelings, ideas which refine our inner soul life in such a way that we do not heedlessly and inattentively fail to notice these things, which are simply part of the reality of our lives, if we did but know it. Education will have a very considerable part to play in this respect in the near future. There is something else that I still need to mention. Just think how infinitely life would be deepened if, to the overall knowledge of karma, one could add such details as the meeting with the Father Principle, that a person whose life ends relatively early has when he dies. For it then becomes clear that it was a karmic necessity for this person to experience an early death, in order that a meeting of abnormal intensity with the Father Principle might take place. For what actually occurs when a meeting of such a kind with the Father Principle takes place? The person concerned is destroyed from without. His physical being is undermined by outward forces. Indeed, this is also the case with an illness. The scene where the encounter with the Father Principle is being enacted is then still here in the physical world. Through the destruction that this external physical earthly world has wrought upon a person, the meeting with the Father Principle is manifested at that very place. And when viewed in retrospect, it does, of course, continue to be visible. The individual concerned is thereby also enabled throughout the entire life that he leads after he has passed through the portal of death to keep firm hold of the thought of the place where, descending from heavenly heights to this earthly location, the Father Principle met with him. This does, however, lead him to want to bring a strong influence from the spiritual world into the physical earthly world. If we consider our present time from this viewpoint and try to experience the weighty feelings that have been aroused within us now at the very mentioning of the meeting with the Father Principle as feelings and not as a mere abstract idea, and if we endeavor to contemplate the numerous premature deaths now occurring with feelings of this nature, we have to say that these were predestined as a preparation for the considerable influence that can stream down from the spiritual world to the physical earthly world in the near future. This is another aspect of what I have been saying for some years when confronted by these tragic events, that these people who are passing prematurely through the portal of death will become helpers in a quite particular way for the future evolution of mankind, which needs powerful forces to extricate itself from materialism. However, all this needs to be brought to consciousness. It must not take place unconsciously or in a subconscious state of mind. It is therefore necessary that there are human souls on earth who can make themselves receptive for this, as I have already indicated, since otherwise the forces emanating from the spiritual world will go in other directions. In order that these forces, which are predestined to be available, can become fruitful for the earth, it is necessary for there to be souls on the earth who imbue themselves with knowledge of the spiritual world. And there must be more and more souls imbued with such a knowledge. So let us try to enable what has to be expressed initially in words, namely the content of spiritual science, to bear fruit. And let us try, with the help of the language that we learn through spiritual science, I mentioned this here in the last lecture, but one, to re-enliven the old insights and ideas that are not for nothing embedded in our modern life. Thus, for example, let us breathe new life into Plutarch's idea that as human beings we are, as physical beings, also imbued with the spiritual aspect, but that, in particular, a person has a higher member which belongs to him spiritually, outside his head, and which, if he is wise, he follows. Let us try to allow the feelings to which I have referred help us not to pass these phenomena of life by unnoticed. In conclusion, I shall leave you today with a thought which is particularly suited to awaken the necessary feelings in our souls. It is unfortunately difficult for many people today in our modern materialistic life to have a feeling for something that mitigates the sorrows of this period of trial, although what is needed is something that goes beyond mitigation, which might be a forlorn hope if materialism continues to prevail at its present level, and its strength is already considerable, and it is likely to become more and more so. It is very, very difficult for many people in our materialistic age to have a feeling for what I might describe as the holiness of sleep. It is a cultural phenomenon of far-reaching significance when one can experience that among those who are regarded as intelligent, there is an absence of any respect for the holiness of sleep. Such things are not said here by way of blame, and they are also not intended to drive people toward some unattainable ascetic goal. We must live with the world, but we must do so with our eyes open. For only in this way can we wrench our bodily nature. And there's text missing. Reader's aside, end of reader's aside. One needs only to consider how many people who spend their evening hours preoccupied with purely material things go to sleep without developing any awareness. And there would be no more than a very dim awareness of this in a materialistic mind. That sleep unites us with the spiritual world. Sleep sends us over into the spiritual world. People should at least gradually become able to develop an awareness of what they can express in words such as these, quote, I am going to sleep. Until I wake, my soul will be in the spiritual world. There it will meet the guiding power of my earthly life, who hovers around my head. There it will meet the genius. And when I awake, I shall have had the meeting with my genius. The wings of my genius will have come in contact with my soul. Close quote. As regards the overcoming of the domination that materialism has over life, a great deal depends on whether or not one makes such a feeling alive within one. The overcoming of this domination can happen only through the awakening of intimate feelings which are also in accordance with the spiritual world. Only if we make such feelings alive within us will our lives in sleep become so intense and the contact with the spiritual world so strong that our waking life will also gradually be strengthened. And we shall then have around us not merely the world of the senses, but also the spiritual world, which is the true, real world. For the world that we generally call the real one is, as I have indicated in the last public lecture, only a reflection of the real world. The real world is the world of the spirit. The little community that is currently devoted to anthroposophically oriented spiritual science will gain the fullest impression of the serious symptoms, the harsh suffering of our time, if in addition to all the other trials to which man is subject today, it learns to feel this time as a test as to whether there are sufficient resources of inner strength and true courage to unite what we need to absorb through our reasoning and intellectual powers in the form of spiritual science with our whole being. With these words, I wanted once more to emphasize what I have often said here, that spiritual science will find its right place in human hearts only when it is not mere theory and knowledge, but when, symbolically speaking, it pervades and enlivens our whole being as the heart's blood of the soul, as intimately as our physical blood pervades and gives life to our bodily organism. The end of Lecture 3.